It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a live webcam set in Katmai National Park and Preserve in Alaska helps biologists and rangers monitor brown bears in their natural habitat. And the public can watch it, and it's really cool. We'll get a firsthand look at what's going on at the falls. Now, a new Republican-backed bill in Congress has the potential to upend our longstanding structure for the federal workforce, permanent nonpartisan civil servants. Called the Public Service Reform Act, its supporters say it's designed to increase accountability by removing current job security protections and making those servants fireable, civil servants fireable at will. Former President Trump in October of 2020 signed an executive order that had similar aims, which President Biden reversed when he came into office. Recent reporting by Axios shows that Trump and his supporters are preparing to resurrect that move and to create a new Schedule F division of federal workers who could be hand-chosen by the chief executive if Trump went back into office in 2025. You can join in at 800-642-1234. It's a little under the radar, but have you been watching this? What are your thoughts on the federal civil service, the bureaucracy? Do you think presidents should have more power to fire more people for more reasons, or do we need that kind of continuity and maybe invulnerability to political interference? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Don Kettle is Professor Emeritus and former Dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland and a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Formerly at UW-Madison, he chaired two blue ribbon commissions for the Wisconsin state government, one on campaign finance reform, another on government structure and finance. Don, welcome back to Wisconsin and to Central Time.
It's great to be with you and all my friends there in Wisconsin, Rob.
Let's set the stage here. This idea of this sort of civil service protection for federal employees goes back a long way. What are the origins of it?
It really goes way back to the 1880s, where President Garfield was assassinated by someone who actually was delusional to the point where he thought he had given a speech that had been responsible for winning the election for Garfield, which of course wasn't true. But because he was delusional, he thought that Garfield owed him a great federal job. He sort of thought that maybe the ambassadorship to France would be good. And so he came and kept asking and asking and asking and got no and no and no for answers. And he was so annoyed that he took a gun and shot Garfield at a train station in Washington and didn't kill Garfield at first. It turns out it was in the early days of modern medicine, and they didn't know enough about how to try to treat gunshot wounds. He got infected as a result and died a few weeks later. But as a result of that, Congress and the administration joined in the idea that they really needed to find ways of protecting federal government service from the people who simply thought that they ought to have jobs in terms of patronage. And one other thing that's important and interesting in the story is that Wisconsin itself was the center of a lot of this movement with Bob La Follette back at the early part of the last century. And he made a tremendous campaign to try to uproot patronage in Wisconsin and replace it with civil service. And so there's a broad national history, but also an important Wisconsin history to this as well.
People might look at this and say, this is kind of an obscure topic, not really a big deal if more federal employees can be hired or fired at will by a president. Make the case that this is a big deal.
It's a big deal in so many ways, but in so many ways that wouldn't really be obvious until problems ended up popping up. For example, back in the last administration, there was, as everybody probably remembers now, a hurricane heading for the Atlantic coast, and there were projections that the Weather Service had made about where it was going to go. And the president, President Trump at that point, had stood up and said, well, you know, that the people in Alabama are threatened by this. And it turned out that they weren't, but he was embarrassed by the fact that he had made such a strong public statement in favor of that. And so he went and grabbed a Sharpie and changed the map for the projection of where the storm was going to go. Well, for those of us living elsewhere, it was just sort of a weird kind of thing. People called it Sharpie Gate. But imagine that you're in a position of trying to decide, do I evacuate or not? Do I trust the evacuation orders or not? Will a political official put enough pressure on the people up above me that I'm going to change my forecast because they want to try to advance a certain particular aim or goal of some kind, or even avoid being embarrassed? If that's the case, am I going to trust the forecast that I'm getting? Am I going to evacuate? How large of an area should we evacuate? That's the sort of thing that could literally cost lives and could be the product of what happens if we remove professionalism from the way in which the public service operates.
Talking to Don Kettle from the University of Maryland and the Brookings Institution about federal employees, their current civil service protections, and a couple of efforts, one from former President Trump, who may be looking to be future President Trump, one from some Republicans in Congress to take away those protections. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Don, I want to look at a couple different threads here. We talked to you before in October of 2020, then President Trump created a new group, a new designation of federal employees that would have allowed him to fire a lot more people if he had wanted. And now he's reportedly working with various groups to do that should he come back to office and come up with lists of loyal potential future employees. Can you talk about that change?
And that's something that's important in the background. And what's changed in the meantime is not only has the president embraced this and his loyalists and his group of Washington think tanks advancing it, but it's now a cause that's been taken up by a large number of Republicans, so that even if Trump is not elected, in fact, even if the Republicans take control of the Congress in the midterm elections this fall, it's very likely we're going to be looking at these issues right off the bat in January. And so these are some big issues that are out there. And the to be sure, a president who's elected certainly has the right to be able to advance the policies that he or she believes are important. After all, elections have to mean something, and that goes for Republicans and Democrats. But the problem is that we also expect that government's going to be administered competently. And there's a real trade-off back and forth between the issues of loyalty on one side and competence on the other. And when we push too hard on one, we end up giving up more of the other. And It's a fine balance that has to be made, but the importance of having competent federal employees for issues that are technical are things that we've seen over and over and over again being incredibly important to us.
Yeah, we've seen some Republicans introduce a bill called the Public Service Reform Act. What would this do?
And this is something actually that was introduced by Chip Roy, who represents us down in Austin, where I'm speaking to you from. And Roy's bill would make all federal employees at-will employees. That is, that they could be fired at will without cause. And what that would do then would make it a whole lot easier when new political officials come in to replace other officials who are existing who may not agree with their points of view. There already are about 4,000 positions in the federal government that new administrations can fill when they come in. Every administration's really struggled to even get those positions filled, but the number of positions that would be covered in Chip Roy's bill, the Civil Service Reform Act that he's talking about, could run into the tens of thousands, possibly as much as 100,000, because it would make every single federal employee potentially at will. The argument is that the private sector has an easier time firing poor performers. Government does not. There are too many protections, they argue. And so therefore, we ought to have a way to be able to make it easier to fire. But the problem is that we have issues of loyalty that often push aside the basic questions of competence. And there really isn't a Republican or a Democratic way to manage air traffic control coming into O'Hare or to take care of the people who are coming through airport security lines either as well. So it's that basic question of how to try to balance loyalty on the one side and competence on the other that really is at the core of this.
And Don, I think an argument from Republicans is the federal bureaucracy, the civil service jobs we're talking about, they say are dominated. They're basically a class that is more loyal to Democrats and that will foil the efforts to make changes by Republican presidents. They're saying, you know, we just need to clear the way so that a Republican president can implement an agenda. What do you think of that argument?
Yeah, the evidence on that is surprisingly murky. It turns out that there surely are Democrats who are in this career civil service and have political protections, but there are a fair number of Republicans as well. For example, the Border Patrol is heavily represented by people who have a Republican leaning, but on the other hand, there are departments like Health and Human Services where people tend to lean a little bit more toward the Democrats. So it's very difficult for reformers to make an argument that the civil service consists of one party or another. Really is a very different kind of animal in different places, but in a sense, people shouldn't have to give up their ability to be able to vote or to make political statements when they join a federal government or even a state or local government workforce, but at the same time, their responsibility is to try to do their jobs, to try to manage programs efficiently, and not to let those political judgments get in the way. So that the idea that we've got to sweep out a whole bunch of Democrats probably isn't true. It's true in some agencies, certainly not true in others. Democrats would make the same kind of argument that they have the problem of trying to sweep out people who are not loyal to them. The main issue that we have is having enough people who have the kind of political ear of the president and can follow his policies or her policies, while at the same time the bureaucracy who's in charge of carrying them out has the highest level of competence possible.
We're talking to Don Kettle, Professor Emeritus, former Dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, formerly at UW-Madison as well, looking at some proposals to change the federal civil service, efforts by President Trump in one instance, Republicans in Congress in another, to say, hey, a lot more federal employees can be hired and fired at will by the president. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this? Have you been a federal employee at these levels? What was your experience like? Do you worry about these changes, what they could lead to, or do you think we need to do something to shake things up in this way? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk about the federal civil service with Don Kettle, Professor Emeritus, former Dean of the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland, talking about efforts in the end of the Trump administration and in planning for a potential future Trump administration, and an effort by Republicans in Congress to take away some job protections for many federal civil service employees, the impact that could have. Still time for you to join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Don, a scenario people worry about is if a president said, say, to mid-level Homeland Security officials, go take ballot boxes, go take ballot information from these four states after this election, bring them to D.C. so we can take a closer look at them. If somebody refuses to do that and points out that they can't, they could be fired and replaced with someone who is more agreeable.
I mean, Rob, that's something that certainly is a risk with the idea of removing civil service protections, because we expect government to be delivered to us regardless of the party affiliation that we may have, or whether we have any party affiliation at all. It was interesting listening to the discussion during the break there about FEMA, for example, and the delivery of services to those who have been suffering in Kentucky because of the flooding. That was not an area that was strong in favor of Joe Biden, but at the same time, we would expect that, and they certainly would expect that, if they're in trouble, that the federal government would come to the rescue with FEMA. There have been problems and discussions in the past about whether or not the declaration of disaster areas were maybe politically influenced, but we certainly would not expect that the decisions about how to come to the aid of people in trouble in this country would have in any way a reflection of how it is that they voted in the last election. And so that's just an example of the ways in which some of these issues, your example, the issue of FEMA, the issues of Kentucky, disaster response, all are issues that are ones that we need to pay careful attention to, because that's the reason why we created these protections to begin with.
Can you give us a sense of how many of these federal appointments are political, because presidents can and do replace some high-level positions, versus the number that are under these civil service protections?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the basics are this, that there are, of course, cabinet officials and sub-cabinet officials, deputy secretaries and assistant secretaries, but all in all, including confidential assistants and others, there are about 4,000 appointments that every president and the people who work for him or her have a chance to be able to make after every election. 4,000 out of 2.1 million federal employees. And so it's really not all that many. The number of political appointees that we have in this country is far higher than in countries like the United Kingdom, where it's just the prime minister and the cabinet secretaries are replaced after elections or new governments are formed. So they're at one extreme, and we're pretty much at the other extreme about the number of political appointees. But The biggest basic problem here is that there's just no president in recent memory who's been very good at filling all those positions at the same time, that there's just a constant effort. And about the time they get finished filling the positions that are available, they have to start all over again because people begin leaving the administration as well. And then there's the trickle out at the end of each presidential term too as well. So even with the 4,000 people the presidents have, there's been a difficult time filling those positions anyway. So if we made it 10,000, 20,000, 50,000, 75,000, if we had even a random collection of people who are being considered for dismissal because of whatever reason that somebody may be interested in removing them, it's just multiplies the difficulty we already have of making sure that we're staffed up and ready to go.
Let's bring on a caller now. Marion is with us in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Marion, hi.
Hi. My comment is that I think it's absolutely ridiculous to try to eviscerate the civil service. We need more competent people, people who base their decisions on experience, on education, on thoughtfulness, a lot more than we need people who base their decisions on politics.
Marion, thanks a lot for the call. And Don, I mean, we keep hearing about polarization. Is this a dying breed, people we can count on for competence as opposed to partisan inclination?
Well, it's a difficult issue, and it's an issue that's become more and more partisan is because as we've gotten deeper and deeper into polarization. But the problems are this. First, that there are some issues that are incredibly complex and require high levels of technical expertise. Even the process of taking a look at x-ray machines to see whether or not you're smuggling something you shouldn't through your luggage in airport security, I mean, that requires a fairly high level of technical training. The FBI has highly trained people who have the kind of skills that are needed for law enforcement and for the kind of investigations on everything from explosives to bank robbers. And we have that to try to deal with. The Secret Service, among other things, is in charge of trying to intercept counterfeit bills. And most of us are not that good at finding really good counterfeiters. So putting all this together, it really does require a fair amount of technical expertise. And it's not to say that there aren't lots of people who get hired sometimes because of who they know. We've got a civil service system that frankly is pretty messed up and requires some fundamental reform. But the idea of replacing that civil service with a at-will system where people can be fired because of their political leanings is something that would be incredibly dangerous.
Thanks for that call. Chris is with us now in La Crosse. Chris, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to point out that the decision to remove someone because they are a poor performer or not, that's something that should be decided at a much lower level than the president or one of his or her political appointees. And so the argument that this is all about getting rid of poor performers is pretty bogus.
Thanks for the call. What do you think, Don?
There clearly are poor performers in government, and it clearly is harder to get rid of them than it should be. But we don't want cabinet secretaries whose job it is to try to make policy and to steer mega agencies like Homeland Security or Health and Human Services. We don't want them having to sit there and trying to think about whether or not that one particular person sitting out there in Eau Claire is maybe perhaps not as loyal as they should be at administering the administration's policy. So that we clearly want to have those kind of protections. We need to focus on ways of trying to do a better job of removing poor performers, but more importantly, to try to make everybody good performers. But quite frankly, that's an issue that the private sector has as well. And I've spent some time looking around at the rate at which people in the private sector are dismissed for cause, where there is a higher level of at-will employment versus the government. And for similar industries, the differences are really not all that much. The big issues have to do with the challenges that managers have in managing well, and especially managing their people well. And that's something the government needs to do better, but something which the private sector struggles with as well.
Time for one more caller. Nathaniel is with us in Campbellsport. Nathaniel, hi.
Hi. A friend of mine and I were talking last night, kind of wondering about the Republican Party's recent interest in Viktor Orban and Hungary. And my buddy had read something online, some sort of analysis of that, and we were just talking about this last night. I can't believe you're talking about this now. That was basically the playbook that they were learning from Viktor Orban. He was just speaking in Texas last week with Trump. So I just wanted the guests' thoughts on that. Thank you.
Nathaniel, thanks for the call. And Don, people have suggested that taking away these civil service protections would take away one, I guess, bulwark against authoritarianism and a slide like we're seeing in Hungary. Is that overstating it?
No, I don't think so, because there's a reason why we created the civil service. There's a reason why we've had it for 140 years. There's a reason why Bob La Follette was the great reformer in Wisconsin for having created this. There's a reason why we want to have politically impartial administration of the law, because we don't want to feel that the odds that we're going to get our street plowed, that we're going to have an ambulance service when we've got difficulties, that we get our Social Security checks on time, that that's going to depend on our political affiliation or where we live. We really expect a competent, solid, nonpartisan government. And on the other hand, though, there is this movement abroad out there that is not just Trump, but involves lots of people. There are big think tanks in Washington, very well funded, advancing these issues. And as the caller pointed out, Nathaniel noted that it's happening in Hungary and elsewhere as well. These are big and fundamental questions that in many ways are sweeping the world, because they get to the basic questions about the role of political power and bureaucracy, and the role of the bureaucracy in democratic countries. So it's not surprising that we're dealing with these issues. They're things that we have to really think very carefully about, because it looks like, as you suggested at the beginning, Rob, this is an under-the-radar kind of issue, but the consequences for all of us and the consequences for democracy could be really quite extreme unless we pay careful attention to the kind of government that we want.
Don, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
So good to be with you.
That's Don Kettle, Professor Emeritus at the University of Maryland. We talked to them about the federal civil service and some potential threats to remove job protections and create thousands more political appointments, the impact that might have. Tomorrow on the morning show with Kate Archer Kent, school desegregation was met with resistance around the country that often led to the firing of black teachers and principals. Find out more with the author of the book Jim Crow's Pink Slip. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Today is a milestone in the history of American technology. As reported at history.com, 85 years ago today, the U.S. Patent Office issued a patent for a device called the Rickenbacker Frying Pan. Doesn't ring a bell? The Rickenbacker Frying Pan was the first ever patent for an electric guitar. That wasn't the only electric guitar in the works back in 1937, but inventors Adolph Rickenbacker and George D. Beauchamp were the first to get a recognized patent for their Electro String Instrument Corporation. Why was it called a frying pan? Well, I looked at a picture. It makes sense right away. The overall shape looks like a long-handled campfire frying pan. That didn't become the industry standard for guitars. A lot of other people were working on electric guitars in that era, including a fellow from Waukesha named Les Paul. The Rickenbacker name, though, went on to be a big part of guitar history. Coming up in 15 minutes, we'll check out some cutting-edge electro-musical innovations happening right now here in Wisconsin. Out of the frying pan, into the news, it's Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, what does a French horn sound like when you play it like a guitar? The director of UW-Madison's Electroacoustic Research Space joins the show to share some of the new sounds he's coming up with. I'm excited about that, and I'm excited about this. When Katmai National Park and Preserves more than 2,000 brown bears wake up from hibernation in the spring, they got to gain hundreds of pounds by fall hibernation season. Brown bears in the park in Alaska travel for food to lakes, harbors, lagoons, and to Brooks River Falls, where the National Park Service sets up live webcams for bear biologists and rangers to monitor those bears in their natural habitat, and for the public to watch the bears in real time. As regular listeners may know, I am a big fan. You can find a link to the webcam at wpr.org/centraltime. Leon Law is the visual information specialist for Katmai National Park and Preserve. Leon, thanks so much for joining us today.
It is always a pleasure to talk about bears.
I love these webcams because whenever I look, there's bears there. What is it that makes Brooks Falls such a sweet spot to see these brown bears in action?
Yeah, so when you think about Brooks Falls, it is unique because we often see high concentrations of bears fishing here, especially during July. And I've been on the platform near the falls myself, and this season seeing 40 plus bears all in one view. And really, it's because of the dynamics of the salmon run, but also the landscape itself. So the Brooks Falls waterfall itself is only 6 feet high, but it spans the entire river, and it creates a temporary obstacle for salmon migrating upstream. So there are high concentrations of fish, which in turn bring high concentrations of bears to the area.
Now, I am a fan from the public, and there are often as many as 2,000 people watching at a time. It's also important, I understand, to bear biologists. What kind of things are they learning by watching these webcams all the time?
We can learn so much about bear behavior and just being able to witness things both during the day and at night and be able to play back moments too. So we can see some incredible natural moments. We learn about bears' fishing styles and habits and preferences as well.
Yeah, I've been watching, and a lot of the fans do too, the different ways these brown bears have to catch salmon. Can you let us know a few of the different techniques we see in action?
Sure. You can see quite a few different fishing strategies. And for instance, there are some bears that'll fish at the top of the waterfall at a place we call the lip. And they essentially wait for salmon trying to jump the waterfall as they move upstream and then catch them as the fish make their way up. And it's a technique that not all bears are able to master. So it really does show skill. And other fishing techniques that we see include snorkeling, diving, a dash and grab technique, which is very active and fun to watch, pirating, and more.
Being able to watch these bears, not just day after day, but literally year after year, we start to see that these brown bears are different from one of the other, different personalities, as you said, different fishing techniques and schools. How important is it to be able to track not just the bears as a whole, but these individual bears?
It really lets us know them as individuals, and we get to see that, and it helps us identify them as well. We don't use collars or anything, so we really ID bears by their physical characteristics, but also more so even perhaps by their habits and their preferences, and getting to watch them as individuals really shows us the range of behavior.
Now, we have black bears here in Wisconsin. You've got brown bears there at Katmai. Can you talk about the weight gain that these guys need to do, mostly or in large part by eating salmon, but they really need to go from skinny to fat in not that much time?
Absolutely. From the beginning of the season to the end of their waking season, essentially, they need to eat an entire year's worth of food in 6 months or less. So gaining fat is really important. During hibernation, they're not going to eat or drink anything, but rely solely off of those fat reserves. And so that's why it's super important for them to put on so much weight. And within a season, we might see bears gain several hundred pounds. And some of our largest bears are weighing 1,400 or so.
Now, you mentioned being on the platform, I think where the camera is, being that close to bears. Sometimes on the screen, I could see people downstream fishing a little bit. I feel like these bears are really big, and I'd be kind of nervous because do I just look like a big salmon to them? What's it like being that close to them in person?
Yeah, I would say every day brings something new to witness and experience. And being that close to them is really pretty incredible to know that we are just visitors in their home. And being able to have this experience and watch them live out their wild and natural lives.
Now, the bears get numbered, and sometimes a name gets attached to them. I know a fan favorite is Otis 480, who's about 20 years old or so now. Are there particular individual bears that you've personally latched onto?
As individuals, you know, you get to see some of these tiny moments. And there are so many bears that I love. I love them all. But getting to see some of those really intimate moments is really pretty fascinating to watch. And so for me, there are definitely different bears that call to me. 151 Walker is one, but then also especially the sows with cubs and watching them grow and learn together. It's really interesting.
And now my entry point, Leon, into the bears there was the annual Fat Bear competition. That's what attracted my attention and led me to find the webcams. Let us know what the Fat Bear contest is all about.
Ah, yes. Fat Bear Week. It is also one of my favorite times of year. And essentially what we do is we take the four photos from early summer and then show them in the later summer when they've gained the weight. And we essentially match bears up against each other in a March Madness style bracket. And then viewers get to choose who ultimately gets crowned the Fat Bear Week champion.
Leon, thank you so much for sharing this. A big fan watching from here in Wisconsin.
Thanks for having me.
That's Leon Law, visual information specialist for Katmai National Park and Preserve in Alaska. She joined us to talk about the live bear cams at Katmai's Brooks River Falls. If you want to take a look yourself, you might get hooked. We've got a link to the bear cam on our website at WPR.org/Central Time. You will see salmon being eaten, so maybe not while you're eating. I don't know. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about backyard baseball.
Remember the classic scene in The Sandlot when Smalls hits a homer into the neighbor's yard? And it turns out the baseball he swiped to do this was signed by Babe Ruth.
Babe Ruth! The Great Bambino!
Well, writer Chris Hardy had his own moment like this back on the farm he grew up on in western Wisconsin.
Midsummer, circa 1973. My brother Kevin and I were playing baseball. Our makeshift diamond had the chicken coop as the backstop, sand and gravel as our infield, a very spacious center field, and no pulling allowed. Our limited supply of baseballs made us search long and hard for balls that disappeared into the weeds. Mom had recently found a great deal on baseballs that were 3 for $1, but the balls turned into mush after a couple of whacks and were pretty much unusable. So we decided to borrow the baseball. Dad was not a collector, but he did have one treasured possession, a baseball that he caught at a 1957 Milwaukee Braves game. 57 was a magical year for Milwaukee baseball. Hank Aaron won the Most Valuable Player Award. Warren Spahn won the Cy Young. Milwaukee won the National League pennant and defeated the New York Yankees in the World Series. Our intent was to return the baseball after we were done playing. Since it wasn't autographed or anything, it would be no harm, no foul. Kevin's Louisville Slugger rested on his shoulder as I leaned in from the mound, a board on a slight rise of sand. The baseball felt good in my hand. The special ball called for a special pitch. Here comes my knuckle curve, Kev, I proclaimed and let it fly. MLB.com says the knuckle curve is one of baseball's greatest paradoxes. It's a pitch very few have mastered and only used when hitters will be fooled by it. I had certainly not mastered the pitch, and announcing in advance was not very deceptive. It really didn't spin or flutter, but just sort of hung in the air. With a flick of the bat, Kevin sent the horsehide-wrapped, cushion-corked ball with its 108 double stitches soaring into the summer sky. We watched in awe as the ball rose higher and higher into center field and went up and over the barn. We stood for a moment, stunned. A good shot was when you hit the side of the barn. Sometimes you can even reach the roof. Never was a ball hit over the barn. Until now, baseball history had just been made. Holy crap, Kev, I said. I think you got all of that one. I think so, he said. Our elation was immediately tempered. That was Dad's ball. We ran into the no man's land behind the barn, a massive thicket of head-high weeds intertwined with old farm equipment. We searched for about an hour before giving up. How were we to break the news to Dad that his precious sports souvenir was gone? We decided to deflect some of the fault to another party who had no knowledge of the crime, but in our minds was really the person to blame. After chores that evening, while we were eating dinner, we told Dad what happened. You did what? His booming voice raised rhetorically. But it was Mom's fault, Kevin said. If she wouldn't have bought those cheap baseballs, we wouldn't have had to use yours. It wasn't fair to gang up on Mom, but it was the diversion that we needed. Dad went from near eruption status to steaming. And we promised to look for the ball again the next day. We never found the baseball. Dad forgave us. The next week, Mom stopped at the local Coast to Coast and bought us some new, real baseballs. We played baseball lots that summer. I never did master the knuckle curve, but I'll always remember the shot heard round the farm.
Chris Hardy is a writer who lives in Taylor. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, a UW-Madison music professor joins the show to tell us about electroacoustic music and how he and his students experiment with instruments and sound. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. What does a French horn sound like in your head? Maybe something like this. All right, but what if you changed how it sounds, say, with a distortion pedal like the cool rock guitar guys do? Pretty cool. That last sound is from a collection of recordings called Air Names. It was made by our next guest with the help of the Electroacoustic Research Space at UW-Madison's School of Music, also called EARS. It's a studio that lets musicians experiment with acoustic instruments, say a French horn or a flute, and electronic instruments like synthesizers and processors to come up with really different kinds of sounds and music. Dan Grabois, an assistant professor of horn and the director of UW-Madison's Electroacoustic Research Space. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Paint us, please, a picture of this lab.
This lab is a former classroom that has been repurposed. So it's in the humanities building, but it doesn't have the aura of the humanities building. It's updated a little bit, and it is chock full of electronic instruments.
What was the inspiration for you to have not just these electronic instruments, but this interface between traditional acoustic instruments and all this electronic gear?
Well, for me, that started when I got to UW. I had before been the chair of contemporary performance at the Manhattan School of Music, and I hired a colleague to come and teach electronic music to my students, and they were making incredible sounds, and I thought, wow, I could change the sound of the horn and play a much bigger variety of music. So when I got here, I was provided with some research funds, and I started buying pedals and microphones and that sort of thing. And I made the Air Names recording that you just played a little bit of, which was mostly featuring the horn in various kinds of distortion and with effects on it. From there, everything derived out of an email that I received one summer, and it said, we are offering a round of UW 2020 large equipment grants. And the idea behind this grant was really, hey, chemistry department needs an electron microscope, and so does biochemistry. So let's provide one electron microscope and have them share. And I thought, well, I could put together a ton of pieces of electronic music equipment and call that large equipment. And so I put in an application. I got everything I asked for. So thank you, Worf.
Now let's check out another clip, another taste of the music. This is from your latest project, released coming out in October, I think, called Fire Names. I think I'm hearing a fairly unprocessed French horn out front there. What's going on behind it, though?
So this really is electroacoustic music. The French horn's completely unprocessed, except that it's being recorded, obviously, mm-hmm. So there's some amount of mixing going on. But yes, so what I did is I wrote a tape track. Of course, there's no tape involved anymore. Everything is digitally recorded. But I used the instruments in EARS to create this 44-minute long tape track, and then I wrote a horn part to go on top of it. And so when I was recording the horn part, which I did in my basement with EARS microphones, I didn't have to distort the horn at all. I wanted it to be very pure, and I played over that tape track.
Now, I'm kind of a music nerd. As I looked at the list of your electronic equipment, it includes things like old Moog synthesizers, a theremin, I think, and then some things I've never heard of, including a Continuum fingerboard.
Yeah, that's actually my, if I had to choose a favorite child, it would be the continuum fingerboard. It's an instrument that's been in production for something like 15 or 20 years, but it changes every few years and is updated. It was invented by someone named Lippold Hocken, who teaches engineering at the University of Illinois. And the reason it's called a continuum is it has a keyboard, but the keyboard is made of squishy foam with the notes more painted on the foam than actual separate notes. So you can drag your finger along the keyboard and make it go continuously, hence continuum fingerboard. And it's a very expressive instrument.
So that makes me like a fretless bass, where usually you'd have distinct notes there, but without the frets, you can move up and down. Same thing. I never would have thought it possible for a keyboard.
Yeah, it's an incredible invention. And it responds also in several other directions. So that side-to-side or X-axis is operating with the instrument, but there's also a Y axis. So the keyboard has a certain thickness, and it's a synthesizer. So for some of the sounds, as you move your finger further away from you or more towards you, the sound will transform. And then the Z axis, how hard you push down, generally controls how loud or soft you play, but it can be programmed to control anything you want.
Talking to Dan Graboy from UW-Madison, director of the Electroacoustic Research Space. We're checking out some of their music, and I want to give a listen to, I think you're featuring your favorite kid, as you said, the continuum fingerboard, in this excerpt from Fire Names. Here's a listen. I think I'm hearing what is the continuum fingerboard with those where you can, yep.
That bass line is continuum fingerboard, but the thing that goes is also continuum fingerboard with a different sound. This is all recorded multi-tracked, so you record one thing and then you put something else on top and you have infinite tracks that you can use.
Okay, one more taste of that, I think. A later part here in Fire Names. Tell us a little more about what we're hearing there.
Right. So everything you heard there is continuum, and it's a big, big, juicy, fat sound on the bottom. And then on top, this sort of Asian-sounding instrument, which is really interesting. It uses that Z axis, how hard you push against it. The harder you push against it, the more it goes boing and bends up. So if you just tap it, it goes ding, 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 ding. And as you push harder, boing, boing, boing. So it makes a really kind of an interesting ornamented sound.
Okay, so this is in effect a music laboratory. What kind of things do music students get in and experiment, slash play with in there?
So I have a band that's a student ensemble. It's actually a class. And the band is called $2 Broom. And if anybody gets the reference, they win the prize for the day. But we improvise using the instruments. So students learn how to play the instruments, which is usually pretty easy. Most of the instruments have a very tactile interface. And in fact, for, say, a cellist or a violinist that has become very, very engrossed in their technique on their instrument, putting their hands in front of the theremin and moving them around and see what happens is a really revelatory experience. It's no longer about just how you make that vibrato with your left hand and how you draw the bow, but just pure experimentation. So we go on stage with this band at the end of each semester and play for about an hour with nothing written down and nothing planned.
Okay, but suppose somebody comes there with a cello or a French horn or whatever. They've devoted their life to this instrument in a lot of ways, and they're playing through some of these processors and synthesizers and things like that. What is their reaction? Is it, this is cool, or wait, this isn't what my instrument is supposed to sound like?
Usually their reaction is something that I can't even quote on the radio.
They're in a generally, good way or a bad way?
In a good way.
Okay.
They're usually so excited about what their instrument will sound like. And we do that. For instance, we had a cellist play on our last concert, and he did some cello playing as well as playing other of the ears instruments. And he was running through effects. And what's so interesting is that you find that your playing changes based on what you're hearing, which is not that surprising, but it really draws that idea into focus, especially as you think of each musician as kind of a composer when you're improvising. So the ideas that are generated are inspired by the sound that's coming into your ears.
Briefly, as we wrap up, live gigs for $2 Broom or any other projects coming out where we could see this in action?
Yes, but you'll have to stay tuned because we set our concerts kind of in the middle of the semester. We figure out a time when everyone's free and when we'll be ready, but they may be billed as the Electroacoustic Improv Ensemble or $2 Broom. I'm not sure how our...
Like any band.
What's the real name?
Yeah.
The real name, as far as I'm concerned, is $2 Broom.
Dan, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you very much.
That's Dan Graboy, assistant professor of horn and director of the Electroacoustic Research Space at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about his work at EARS and to share some of the experimental music he's made there. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, the Titanic might be the most famous shipwreck of all time, but it's not alone. The author of the new book, Sinkable, takes us on a tour of the millions of shipwrecks around the world and efforts to find and salvage them. Plus, a look at the latest research on the impact of COVID on kids and the possible long-term effects. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.